Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I did want to make one quick notation. As I think everybody knows, the Whitman campaign chose not to attend, not to send anyone. We wanted to make sure that we had a Republican perspective offered on the panel, and so we invited three very distinguished Republicans to join the panel: Duff Sundheim, the former chairman of the Republican Party; Bob Naylor, former Republican Assembly Leader and former chairman of the party; and Jim Brulte, former Republican leader in the Assembly and the Senate, and also the only panelist ever to show up wearing a Harley jacket, which I like. I just wanted to note for the record that none of them were directly a part of the Whitman campaign, and they're not here to speak for the Whitman campaign. They're here to speak for themselves, to give us a Republican perspective, but they're certainly free to say whatever they want about the election and about the Whitman campaign. And with that, other than that, I will turn it over to our moderators from the LA Times, Kathy Decker and Anthony York.
I'm Kathleen Decker with the LA Times. Next to me is Anthony York, formerly Capital Weekly in the LA Times, now exclusively LA Times. Ethan introduced our Republican colleagues from the right, not necessarily ideologically. We have Roger Salazar, who was involved with the California Working Families Independent Expenditure Group. We have Sterling Clifford, who has promised to make news and talk a lot today. More than the eight words he uttered yesterday, anyway. We have Joe Trippi. We have Steve Glazer, who's also promised to make news. So, with that, this is picking up from what was discussed in the primary panel yesterday. So let's just start from the morning of the day after the election. On the Democratic side, you've had a candidate who's been able to pop up a little bit throughout the spring, but without a contested primary. You're now facing someone with a truly unlimited budget, and the probability that that morning, if not a day or two later, she'll start hammering you on the head with it. And on the Republican side, your candidate has come out of a rough primary election, at which an issue that she didn't necessarily want to talk all that much about became the focus of the last month or 6 weeks of the campaign. The social issues that she had tried to sort of put on the back burner had become prominent. What is your thinking at that moment, as the general election's about to start, about what your strengths and weaknesses are and what's to come? Start on the Republican side.
Well, I think that the major concern, as you mentioned, was after the Arizona legislation was passed and Steve Poizner ran those very effective ads, which brought him within single digits. I think the Poizner campaign said their private polling even showed them pulling slightly ahead. Even though they were able to swing it around in the primary, and by May 15th they felt very comfortable about the primary, they saw her negatives shoot up during that period, and they were very concerned about that fact. So their feeling was it was going to be a war of attrition. They didn't feel that they were ever going to be able to jump into the horseshoe, but they were confident that they had a good chance to win the race.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Yeah, by the way, I can't resist this. Jack Citrin yesterday said USC had athletes, Cal has students. Let the record show that Stanford has both.
That's a different panel.
I think that when the dust settled in the primary, the Whitman campaign was over. They didn't necessarily know it, but there were four fundamental disabilities, which I can get into more later, that they had to overcome at that point. One is the immigration issue had been ripped open, and that, I think, in California is just fatal for the Republicans. The second is that they were convinced they had to win the tax and spend issue, and they hadn't laid a glove on Jerry Brown over the tax and spend issue, and they tried and tried and tried through the summer, but the facts didn't support the tax and spend attack. I served 4 years under Jerry Brown's first governorship, and he was not a profligate spender or a big taxer. Third, the likability factor had already been set in, the unlikability factor, and the avoidance of press over a period of time, and the press writing about it, and it getting on the evening news, and then is out there to be picked up in the in ads run by the opponents, just wears you down. And I can't imagine what the Whitman campaign was thinking, at least after the first couple of months. I could understand she needed to get her feet on the ground, but it persisted throughout the campaign. And then finally, Arnold was really unpopular in June. And that was, we talk about the rest of the country, but the rest of the country was mostly replacing Democrats with Republicans. Here was a Republican trying to replace a very unpopular Republican who became increasingly unpopular the longer the budget dragged on. I just think it was an impossible thing starting right after the primary.
Yeah. First of all, I have great sympathy for the people that worked on the Whitman campaign. I wasn't here for the discussion about polling yesterday. I understand it was interesting, but I believe that if you look back at the history of elections, notwithstanding polling, which simply takes a picture of one set of candidates at one specific time on one specific day, if you look at the history of elections, particularly in California, I think it was always going to be difficult for Meg Whitman or any Republican to beat Jerry Brown. Voters tend to make the same decisions again and again. There's an inverse relation between president's approval and how the other party does in midterm elections. And that generally plays itself out, as it did in this election. And, you know, since I was four, it's only not played itself out in two election cycles. And I'm going to be 55 in 2 months. In California, with the exception of Steve Poizner, we have not elected a non-incumbent Republican statewide in a regularly scheduled election since 1994. And that was an election where Pete Wilson was running at the top of the ticket. It was a great year for Republicans, and Kathleen Brown, to our benefit, decided to run out of money and come down with television ads the last couple weeks of the campaign. So California is a state that, all things being equal, wants to vote Democrat. That was hurdle number one for Whitman or Poizner or Campbell or whoever. Second of all, when it comes to electing a chief executive, voters are very discriminating. Again, with the exception of Reagan and Schwarzenegger, and I'm not even sure you can use Schwarzenegger because it was a special, it was an interesting aberration of an election. But with the exception of those two people who started with near universal name ID and a positive image, in modern history, we've not elected a governor who has not first held statewide office. Earl Warren, Pat Brown, Jerry Brown, George Duke Majan, Pete Wilson, Gray Davis, all held statewide office before they were elected governor. It's one of those criteria that voters look for when they pick a chief executive because they get that governing is hard. And for those who say voters are not discriminating, let me point out how discriminating they are. When you're going to be one of one, they want that level of experience. None of the last five U.S. senators elected statewide in California held statewide office prior to being elected U.S. Senate. When you're going to be one of 100, voters do not expect that level of experience or require it. So I think going into the election, no matter who the Republicans would have nominated, we're at a disadvantage against Jerry. Now, I can say, let me just finish. I can say that I think Poizner would have been a little stronger, but I can't prove that. But since he had held statewide office, I think he would have been stronger, but I do think he would have had difficulty, which is why I advised him not to run for governor. So coming into the race, I think Jerry Brown started with a competitive advantage. Does it mean Meg Whitman couldn't have won? No, I think she might have, but it would have required her to do everything right and for the other side to make some mistakes. She, in fact, her campaign started with a disadvantage. They did not do everything right. And frankly, the other side did just about everything right.
Did you guys think that experience was still an advantage, given the national climate? Was it clear to you that experience, that this was going to be sort of a replay of 98, that experience was going to be an asset in this election?
We thought it's going to be a walk in the park. I'm surprised we even went to work. I mean, these guys have laid it out pretty well, huh?
We did everything we could to try to change that dynamic, but we failed miserably.
Because we had to justify that we were being paid, so...
Well, in the summer, you were nowhere to be found anyway, right? Jerry Brown was nowhere. There was a lot of hemming and hawing among Democrats, and there was this proxy campaign that popped up, right? The Working Families campaign, and this was sort of an aberration as well. This cycle.
But Anthony, let me go back and just to set the stage, okay, and to be a little bit more serious. When we moved to the post-primary situation, obviously we had done our research, we had a sense of our strengths and our weaknesses, and really a lot of the discussion, and we had an ad in the can in case we had to go on the air, but the focus really was about our fundraising. How much money could we raise and how much flexibility did we have to engage with the Whitman campaign? Were they to come out of the box and attack us? And at that point in time, our best expectations were that we were going to have about a $30 million campaign. And what that meant was is that we had about a reasonable level of ads for about 8 weeks. And if we wanted to stretch it, maybe we could do 10 weeks. And so that calculation meant that we had about 2 weeks in the summer that we potentially could go on the air and not have a dark week after Labor Day. And so a lot of our discussions were about how much, what our resources situation was, and if Whitman went up, could we go up and respond or not? And that was the spirit of discussion we had internally.
Yeah, I'd just add to that we all talked a lot in the waning weeks of the primary about what we're going to do right afterwards or what we thought or hoped they would do. And I think all of us hoped they'd stay on the air. We thought the worst thing for us would be if they went dark.
Why? Why is that?
Because if go dark June, July, August, and come up fresh and outspend us the rest in the meat of it would be the big. That was one of my biggest fears. I think Steve, all of us sort of thought, man, if please let them just stay up and become the old tired thing, hopefully, when we finally had money to go up. And then I think the second thing is I really do believe he doesn't like to take credit for things, but Steve's credit for really kind of forcing real discipline to not go up. There were a lot of, we had a great kitchen cabinet, a great team, but there were disparate voices. People really were making a big case to go, go positive right now, burn some money in that summer period. And plus all the pressure across the state, pundits, party folks, everybody sort of banging, elected officials banging on us to, please do something. Where's the campaign? It was a lot of pressure, and I think Steve and the hierarchy of the campaign really enforced real discipline with a real plan that we followed and stuck to. And then she stayed up, which I think was a mistake. I think that was a mistake for them to stay up, but,
Right. The discussion was that if she attacks us, do we respond or not? And she went dark for 2 days after the primary on Wednesday and Thursday. Her media consultants were on the ledge. They were there of the Hyatt Regency in San Francisco. They were on the ledge. They had to pull them back off the ledge, and they went back up on the air on Friday. And they did go up with a positive ad, so that made us rethink, so she's going to try to reset her image. It was a brutal, a tough primary, and so she started positive, but then very quickly the next week she went negative with her big 40 years of failure ad. It was a one-minute ad that was well-produced and well-researched. It focused in on the thing that we were most concerned about, and that was the tax and spend charge. And that became, for us at least, you know, I counted them up. We had 5 start dates for our advertising before we actually went up on the air at Labor Day, where we had an ad. We're prepared to reserve the time. We're going to have to respond because we can't have her saying negative things about us and not respond. And so that was, I think, one of the toughest choices that we had internally, particularly the first one, because that ad seemed so tough. Is this hurting us? Is it not? Can we let an attack go unresponded to? And that's really where we were during the second week in June.
Well, how much of that pressure and the pressure from outside and internally was from the recent example of Phil Angelides in 06? I mean, whether it's accurate or not, the conventional wisdom seems to be that Angelides came through this bruising primary with Steve Westley, and then the Republican Party spent money that summer, right after the primary, and Angelides never recovered.
Right. I would say that's one example, but it's the conventional wisdom in politics that you don't let an attack go unanswered, period. It's just not something you do. And obviously we saw that play out with Angelides. But that's how you see that play out in, you know, campaigns small and large.
But one of the big differences is that in 2006, Schwarzenegger didn't have a primary, so he hadn't been up on the air all through the spring and early summer.
Well, we saw I was going to say, from the independent, expenditure side of things, you know, we had taken a cue from that example. It wasn't going to be the same race. Jerry Brown is not Phil Angelides. We had worked on a race against Jerry in the primary for Attorney General, and you know, there's he has a lot of strengths, and there's a lot of inoculation that comes from his many years of experience in politics the voters just generally seem to like him. But we did sort of our calculation, in the winter of 09, or the end of 09, looking, working the math on the back of a napkin, and sort of said, if Jerry does everything right, if Jerry raises every dollar he can from every Democrat who's ever given to a Democratic, gubernatorial candidate under the new limits that are out there, if he does everything perfectly, he could get to about $45 million or so, which, as Steve mentioned, earlier, their calculation was the same as ours. That could probably get you, 8, 10, 12 weeks of, but also leaves you vulnerable in the summertime. And so what we wanted to do with the independent expenditure that we put together was create sort of a single progressive group to prevent, again, it wasn't going to be the same campaign, but we did not want to happen to Jerry what happened to Phil in 2006. Even if it was just a couple of points that Whitman would be able to sort of gain an edge on, we didn't want her to be out there on their own. We put together our own plan of what we wanted to do with our independent expenditure group to do the research in March and April, prepare ads by May, and stealthily raise money by asking for commitments instead of cash, so that we could spring it on Meg in June, and if we needed to. There were a couple of other independent expenditure groups that popped up in the meantime, which forced us to be a lot more public than we wanted to be about what we were doing. But again, the entire goal for us was to be ready and have some research-driven ads that would help level the playing field, as as the other guys call themselves, in this campaign, and keep it so that when Jerry was ready to do whatever he wanted to do, he didn't have to worry about these summer months.
Sterling, during this period of time, you also had the sort of good luck of an alleged serial killer and civic crooks helping out the then Attorney General. The Bell story came up. He was huge on local news in Southern California on that. The Grim Sleeper case came up. He was all over the news on that. How much did his ability to generate free press during that span of time, when the other side's up on the air and you're getting assistance from labor, but he's trying to essentially raise money, how much did that impact, keeping your head in the game? More than that, please.
Up to 10
the
words.
The answers have to be longer than the question.
I hesitate to acknowledge a serial killer or horrific corruption at the local level as good luck. So I want to say up front, I think everyone can agree that it would be better for everyone had those things not happened. But it was good. People do still watch TV news, and people do still read the paper, and they all those blogs have original source material. So there's some value to traditional media coverage. despite speculation to the contrary, at least I think. So obviously that was useful. And then, you know, it kept up the contrast that we wanted, that Jerry Brown wasn't a politician. He was a public servant, and he was doing this job on behalf of other people. And that's the thing that he was going to bring to the governor's office, was more than, you know, his desire to be governor, but his experience dealing with those issues and his, you know, his desire to do something good and productive for the state of California. And here are these examples of him doing just those things.
And while the independent expenditure ads are up, these are ads and messaging that you have no control over, right? The campaign is not legally allowed to coordinate. So a couple of things. Number one, it seemed like the moves were very telegraphed publicly. I mean, it seems like the press was used for communicating that message. How were you guys able to sort of de facto coordinate through earned media? And also, what were the concerns internally of not having control over the message directly? I mean, did you have concerns over, or was there faith in the work that the unions were going to do during the summer?
We weren't, you know, we didn't coordinate, didn't know, and didn't really pay a whole lot of attention. I mean, it was, you know, good that it happened, but what I'm saying is at that time we were doing things like, we were thinking hard about putting a bell spot up. I mean, taking advantage in Southern California in particular and putting it up. But Jerry, again, just who he is, just said no way. I mean, he was doing his job as Attorney General, didn't want to politicize it, thought it would be a mistake to politicize it. I mean, you know, if he did a good job as Attorney General that during the summer, that would be the best thing he could do. So, I mean, we were sort of, again, as Steve said, there were like four or five different potential start dates to go on the air, and we made several spots that never made the air, which during that whole period, and kind of like, you know, would take a look at public, a lot of times it'd be public polling, it would all be all we had, but, you know, make decisions about, but we all had, in the end, just didn't want to go up until as late as possible, until we really could, you know, afford it the rest of the way and be on as even a keel as possible. So we never ended up pulling the trigger, and the polling never got out of whack, whether it was, you know, the independent expenditure or things that they were doing. It never got out of whack enough to make us say, we just got to go.
We were trying to be as obvious as we possibly could with the moves that we were making. Again, we were counting on, we had watched Jerry during the spring, saw the discipline that he had, even though he, you know, people were jumping all over him to get in, to do something, to be more visible, to, you know, start, to, you know, to go out onto the campaign trails So we were, you know, we just tried to be as obvious as we could and telegraph our moves as much as possible it's not traditionally the way you want to run a campaign, because you're letting, you know, in this case, the opponent is Whitman, know what your strategy is up front as well. So, you know, it's a sort of a double-edged sword on it. But we were, as we sort of put these spots up, we were counting on Jerry's discipline that he showed during the springtime, we're hoping that, you know, we were being obvious enough to make our intentions clear to anybody who was paying attention.
On the Republican side, as the summer progresses just a little bit away from the primary, you have a candidate running ads, and they're almost immediately getting slammed as disingenuous, as not really relying on facts. You have a candidate who has to go back and forth over whether an altercation with an underling at her previous job was physical or verbal. You have her sort of the backwash still from what position she's actually taking on immigration. How early did it become apparent to you that there was a credibility issue here that might affect how people even, and whether people even listened to the charges she was making against Brown in the summer?
I think she had trouble going there. I wonder what the Brown folks think, because they, of course, saw the polling. None of us did. We weren't involved with the campaign. But I think she set the table when she was 50 points up or 48 ahead of Poizner and then went negative. She really laid the foundation for undermining her credibility as a fresh new face. That was point number one. Going up as hard as she did right after the primary, I mean, think about this. By Labor Day, Jerry Brown, who was governor when I was in high school, was the fresh new face in the governor's race. And so I think part of the way she conducted the primary, I mean, it's nothing wrong with attacking your opponent. I probably would have waited until he threw a shot on television. But I think she set the table for that. And because of her inability or lack of desire to interact with the press, I thought it allowed a narrative to be built that long term was not going to be helpful to her.
I was worried, very worried, when there was no, despite all the money she was spending, there was no traction, obvious traction. Mm-hmm. And I think that all that advertising about tax and spend was neutralized by what I think may be the most brilliant single sentence in the campaign, and that is, no new taxes without a vote of the people. And there were Republicans who voted for Jerry Brown because he said that over and over, quite a few of them.
When the period from the primary to Labor Day was very important because from the Whitman perspective, they wanted the race to be about the issues, jobs, the economy. They did not want it to be about character. They felt that they were vulnerable on that because of the no voting and other stuff in her past, especially, you know, with the independent voter, her history at Goldman Sachs and stuff like that. So they knew there were some real problems on the character side. So they wanted it to be about the issues. They were correct that, you know, after the primary, they did some positive ads. That really didn't get them any traction. There was all the blowback. So the fact that they had spent all that money, Jerry was off on some island during that 3-month period, and they wake up on Labor Day and the numbers hadn't moved at all, was a major concern.
Some of the focus grouping that we were doing in March and April, sort of leading up to the general election, we were a little worried about independent women and even some softer Democratic women because they were not buying. We were testing a bunch of messages about Meg's businesses, you know, and that she was a bad businesswoman or a corrupt businesswoman or whatever the case may be. And none of that stuff really worked very well, especially with some of those swing folks. So what we saw did work was that you couldn't trust her. And so that's sort of why when we laid out our ads in the general, we went after sort of the trust issue. And even a lot of the things that we talked about, whether it was 28 years ad that we did, the Y spot, we call it, that ad, people always talked about it, asked us why we hit on the 28 years thing. And it was more about her response to not voting for 28 years than it was the actual not voting, in that she sounded like a politician. She sounded like she was, she was basically becoming everything she said she wasn't going to be, and she wasn't fresh anymore.
Was it the combination of being a billionaire and not voting, or the not voting? I mean, is there a way to sort of tease out, did you tease out in the focus groups whether people saw, translated it, that into opportunism?
Yeah, and I think why didn't she get involved before? And again, couple that with the political speak, that the Brown campaign definitely took advantage of with their echo spot later on down the road. I mean, she just sounded scripted. She sounded, and again, couple that with the billionaire item, just made her seem like they just couldn't relate to her, and they didn't know what her motives were. And that's sort of what we were trying to tease out with the spots that we were working on.
Yeah, it should be noted that the voting hit was a good one, but if you notice in our advertising, we never used it.
Yeah, why not?
Because there were so many other good things to say.
I just teed that up for you. You're welcome, Steve. You're welcome.
Did you see the smile on his face, though, when he said, there were so many good things?
So it was a good ad, and it did raise some good questions foundationally, and we were happy to see them go on the air. We had no knowledge of it, and they did a good job, and we appreciated it.
One of the things that was in that first Whitman ad, there was a clip from the 1992 presidential debate, right, with Bill Clinton, that later was broken out as its own ad, but it was Bill Clinton attacking Jerry Brown. Was that a concern for you guys? Were you worried that that was going to be a viable attack and pry off some Democrats?
Well, at first blush, I think we all felt it was a very effective ad on a lot of levels, including the clip from Bill Clinton. And so I think there was a lot of concern about the effect of it, and it led into our first big decision about whether we needed to respond or not. But I mean, the good news for us is that, to paraphrase Winston Churchill, there is nothing in life so exhilarating as to be shot at without result. And for us, at least, here we had an ad that had everything in it, our vulnerabilities in the whole kitchen sink, including President Clinton, who remained very popular in California, raising an issue about our consistency, our candidate's consistency, along with a whole host of issues. And so we did track, you know, we did try to pay very close attention as to whether we were being heard or not. And the good news for us was, politically at least, it was a shot without result.
Did it not track because they felt they knew Jerry Brown and that couldn't possibly be true, or because they didn't believe who was saying these things about Jerry Brown?
Well, I think, you know, one of the interesting things about this campaign, and Joe and Sterling may enhance this, is that, we're proud of the campaign. There's a lot of things we think we did right. We didn't make too many mistakes and all that. But we did come into this campaign with a foundational base of Jerry Brown. Jim Bognett talked about it yesterday about the brand. And so we had a candidate who had served in public office for 25 years in some elected public office. He had made thousands of decisions at all different levels that people could watch and observe, and that people had more than a first impression of him. It wasn't just a first impression through some advertising, that there was, at least if you're over the age of 50, some foundational knowledge about him. And as Mr. Naylor indicated, it wasn't a record that had as a reinforcement a lot of the things that they were saying, not just on the issue of taxes and spending, but on the issue of crime. Not everybody thought that Rose Byrd remained the biggest issue on criminal justice, or the death penalty was a front and center concern, that he somehow was against job creation. There was just a lot of stuff in there that I think the conclusion in hindsight was that on so much of what they did, they went over the top.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think we saw it in that ad, and we saw it in subsequent advertising.
What I'd say is that there was a totally different tone to what they were doing, what we were doing. I mean, we're being tough. But their tone was so snarky and so over the top and so, you know, failure follows him everywhere. I mean, it was like just sort of, you know, it's like, okay.
I mean, remember that one.
It was almost like, no, but I mean, it's almost like it would have been better to say, look, he was a good governor back then. But, and, I mean, sort of gives, because that's sort of where people were. I mean, give them, you know, Jerry's authenticity, give it to him. And, you know, but the way they did it and how ferocious they did it and how early they did it, particularly when she, I don't think, was still that yet defined, was another thing I wish they were here to talk about, because I think the tone was very, I think the tone that they were using really made voters just say, you know.
When President Clinton came and repudiated it, probably.
Well, that's later on.
Yeah.
Right.
But that's when that came.
The end of the summer.
The one thing that we know, and I know that it sort of backfired on them, because, you know, we had a little bit of a glitch in our campaign where one of the folks, one of the groups that was supposed to provide some funding for a flight of ads didn't come in until a couple of weeks late. So we were off the air for a good 3 weeks in late July. And so there were no ads against Meg. She was running her spots, and her negatives kept going up. I mean, she had no traction. It was nothing I'd ever seen in a campaign before, where they were up by themselves and they were hurting themselves. I mean, I don't know what you guys saw in your polling, but,
and you know, when you look at the 40 years of failure ad, especially, there's some things in there that it becomes sort of emblematic of the whole campaign. You know, there are a lot of things, bad things you can say about Jerry Brown that people will believe. But if one of the 9 attacks you have in a 60-second ad is Jerry Brown was a lobbyist for corporate polluters, People just don't believe that, and it almost doesn't matter what. Like, that's so counter to the established conventional wisdom about Jerry and who he is and what his politics are, that people don't buy it, and it undercuts your credibility the rest of the way through. And I think, you know, when you get to the end of the campaign, and I know we'll get to the Pinocchio ad later, I'm sure, but what we never got when the Pinocchio ad came out was pushback on whether she really was fundamentally dishonest. You could argue whether the ad itself was a little over the top. But nobody said Meg's actually a pretty truthful person, because at that point we had a whole summer of these things that were sort of unbelievable being pushed so aggressively about Jerry Brown that they didn't really have any credibility left.
So one of the big questions in the sort of looking forward to the campaign in the late winter was if she really was going to spend $150 million, at what point would that spending become counterproductive? So you're essentially saying that as far back as the summer, back from election day, the stuff she was throwing against the wall was hurting her more than helping her.
Let me. There was a period of time, the last 3 weeks of July and the beginning of August, where there was nothing on the air except for her ads, no independent expenditure ads, and we were polling at that time. And the question that we asked was, "Have you seen any of the ads by Meg Whitman against Jerry Brown?" And we asked, if you've seen them, did they make you feel better or worse about Jerry Brown? And it was like, you know, 8 or 9 points better, 4 or 5 points less. And these are her attack ads. And then it said, did those ads make you feel better or worse about Meg Whitman? And it was like 23, 24, they felt less about her, and about 7 or 8, they liked her better. So 3 to 1. It was raising her negatives. It was an incredible phenomena that we tested. Jim Moore was doing our polling, and he created the question set to make it clear what we were now seeing in the horse race numbers. They weren't moving. They were moving our unfavorables up a little bit, but they were actually moving her unfavorables up a little bit more. And it was amazing to see.
And yet, I mean, is that a cumulative effect, or because Whitman had the airwaves to herself in the primary too, right?
And arguably, it was. You know, remember, in the primary, with the exception of Steve Poizner, his family, and a few close friends, theoretically, Meg had 99% of the Republican base that she could get to vote for. In a general election, it's different. Most of the Democrats are not going to vote Republican. Most of the Republicans are not going to vote Democrat, and you're talking to the swing. So in a general, the ability to move the meter is much more difficult than in a primary. And in this case, because of the stage that was set, I think, it shows that she was moving the meter. It just was moving the wrong way.
Well, I mean, politics is particularly, you know, I think advertising and talking to people is a lot more just like kitchen table human nature. If someone came through that door right now that none of us knew and said that Phil Traunstein is a crook, right?
We'd all agree, but still dislike the person.
He's a lot of things, but he's not.
Even though all of us know that to be true, we would wonder, like, who the hell is this person who's doing this? I mean, like, well, you know, what are you doing? And so for her to, like, so quickly, I think, on Poizner and it sort of being new to the, you know, in terms of how California viewed her, to take this path and hurt her own credibility in the end. I mean, they hurt her credibility with some of the charges and the way they handled things, particularly on the Clinton ad, where they, you know, once they put that thing up and once it was clear that CNN got it wrong and that Bill Clinton was saying it's wrong and, you know, take it down, and they kept it up, and she kept saying, I stand by it. Yeah, I mean, this campaign in the end was about trust. Who are you going to trust to fix this mess? And they already had some sense of trusting Jerry's authenticity, particularly they had some view about him in the past, and there was something real about him. And here's this person who's just coming off the, you know, just coming out of nowhere, and all she's doing is make, you know, basically losing credibility, attacking the tone, the whole thing. I just think there were some real errors there. I don't know what would have happened had they stayed dark June and July and August and done it differently and not sort of wore her out. But I do think there were a bunch of things that they were doing that did not, you know, in the end, they don't make sense.
But keep in mind, just to keep the record straight, that we were even in the polls coming out of the primary. The public polls that came out later in June, we were even. That it wasn't that this revisionist history, like her candidacy was doomed from the start, is a little tough to swallow. You know, she had started her initiative with the Latino community by running very creative Spanish ads. It got a lot of attention, you know, World Cup TV, very expensive to buy, that she was on the air with Spanish TV ads, Spanish radio ads. I mean, many, many of them opened up an office in East L.A. She certainly was engaged in a serious initiative to go to the center on Latino issues. And so they were doing a lot of things that we certainly were concerned about. But it wasn't like her candidacy was flattened and was falling now off the cliff.
I do think that as the summer progressed and they kept piling up those inaccuracies in their ads, and they kept the newspapers kept fact checking them, the sense of it, at least as the summer wore on, again from her own doing, was that look, they didn't have to do that. They could have been negative in their tone and factual at the same time if they wanted to, but they were negative and, you know, lying at the same time. So it's not a good combination.
But the Clinton ad wasn't necessarily noteworthy for the ad itself. I mean, before it was fact-checked, remember Jerry Brown had his own reaction to that ad, which was caught on tape when he was speaking to a room full of Democrats. And you know, he made a joke about the president's past, and that sort of, that sparked something that I think a lot of people covering the campaign didn't know how that was going to play out, was his was Jerry's ability to go off script, right, and say things sometimes that you didn't know what he was going to say. There was an incident of him meeting a reporter up in the Berkeley Hills and comparing the Whitman media effort to Nazi Germany.
No.
He said it was Goebbels like. No, that's not what happened.
Talking about propaganda.
Oh, right.
What more?
How was Goebbels was not a member? Well, anyway, we can have this discussion later.
He was jogging, stopped at a drinking fountain. Fair. In context.
Okay, but all that, all those details.
What more did you want us to try to do? I mean, we're doing everything we could for these guys.
Well, Sterling, I mean, what sort of communications challenge does that present when, I mean, you know this going in, right?
Yeah, sure. Lasso, you know, I think, you know, Jerry's willingness to say what he really thinks. One, there's a degree to which that is more legend than fact at this point. I mean, there were a couple of kind of high-profile incidents where, he said some things in unguarded moments that were not helpful to the campaign necessarily. But let's be real about it. It wasn't a daily occurrence. It wasn't a weekly occurrence. It wasn't a monthly occurrence. You know, Jerry, if nothing else, I mean, you know, the guy started appearing in political campaign posters for his father and in family photographs when he was like two. So this is not a new environment to him. Does he say what he's thinking? Sure, he does. And a lot of his thought process occurs out loud and in public when he's working through how he really feels about issues. But, you know, if you're in a position where you can have conversations with the candidate, which, you know, we were because of the size of our operation and the way Jerry works, you know, fortunately, most of the time, we knew what he was thinking before he said, you know, anything in public. So very little of what he said actually came as a surprise to those of us who worked on the campaign. And you know, again, those things were inconvenient, but Jerry's authenticity was a big part of the reason people voted for him in this campaign, and that's the downside of authenticity. So, you know, you have to take the bad with the good a little bit.
On the Republican side, as you have been through a lot of campaigns in the past and see these problems looming, see them getting bigger and bigger, what was the dynamic with outsiders and the Whitman campaign? How willing were they to accept well-meaning suggestions, if any, if at all? And was there any sort of effort, sort of panic moment when people went to her campaign and said, she's coming off as unlikable, she's coming off as not telling the truth, this thing is going downhill fast?
Well, I never had any communication with the Whitman professionals, so I can't really answer that question. I'm not aware of any kind of surge of people trying to warn her that it's going awry. It just didn't come to my attention, but these two gentlemen are much better connected.
You know, I had a couple of communications, and I gave some advice, and frankly, they took the advice I gave them on one occasion, and I offered to help do something on one occasion. They chose not to do that. But I found the guys who are professionals who've been involved in California Republican politics for a long time. They wanted to win, and they were willing to talk to whoever had good ideas.
Well, I think a lot of people felt that if there ever was a campaign in the history of California that was doing enough polling that knew where they stood, this would be the one. So I think there was a strong feeling that, you know, my voice, I mean, I may not be seeing the same stuff they're seeing, but they're seeing more than I'm seeing. So in terms of, oh, my God, there's a problem here. I mean, you could clearly see it in mid-October. I don't want to get out of the chronological order here, but when you had Obama, Clinton, and Palin come out, you could just see, you know, it's kind of like, okay, this is the last round, and this is going to be very difficult to overcome. So I think the sense was we're seeing the same things they do. In a campaign, are there a lot of people that think that they have the answer and feel that they weren't listened to as much as they should? Yes. Were there a lot of people in this state on the Republican side that felt that way this time? Yes. Has that happened before? Yes.
And will it happen again?
Yes.
Yeah.
By the way, she spent over $1 million on polling and focus groups through the summer. So it underscores the belief that they had a lot of data points in which to rely upon their strategy and their message. That was more than we spent on overhead in our entire campaign.
What, skipping ahead to the first debate in September, it's for a lot of Californians, a polling show throughout the year that a lot of younger Californians particularly didn't really have a strong sense of who Brown was. How important was that to casting his impression among those people? And what did your sort of polling afterwards show that people had gotten from it? And from the Republican side, how do you think that either changed or enforced any dynamic going on?
Well, we could certainly see in our polling that those under the age of 50 had a higher level of undecided about Jurek, so that he was less known. It wasn't a dominant element of our strategic thought. There were a lot of other things that were more important to us than those under the certainly those under the age of 30. To some extent, those between the ages of 35 and 50 were of note. And so we did, when we first went on the air, we've now moved to Labor Day, and after making a choice not to go on the air five different times prior to that, we actually had a discussion internally about maybe we could wait another week. And that is a true story, because we're only down, now we're at Labor Day, we're only down a couple points. Rasmussen and I think SurveyUSA had us down 7 or 8, and that was getting a lot of attention, and the cat calls from the gallery were continuing to pour in. But our own polling, which we relied upon, had us down about 2. And so we did decide, in terms of our first ad that Joe did, to do a semi-biographical spot to deal with those who didn't know Jerry as well. And so we did take the time, and Joe can talk about the ad if he wishes, to reflect on some elements of his record to kind of get people up to speed.
The ad, maybe you may remember, it started out with shots of the old the limo, the mansion, and again, one of the things we wanted to do was remind people how frugal the guy was, and who he really was. In turn, we all know, anybody who's ever worked for Jerry Brown knows how frugal he really is. This is one campaign where nobody did anything for the money. Did it because we believed a small group who really believed in the guy, which also made it very easy to make a lot of the decisions. But you know, we had a really good kitchen cabinet, a group of people who'd been, and there's always a group of folks like Peter Coyote who agreed to do the voiceover on that ad. So it's kind of trying to have all these assets and put them together in a way that drives the message. And the other thing I'd say is really easy about working for Jerry is he knows who he is, what he wants to do, and what he wants to say. So you're not trying to work with scripts or anything like that. I mean, the things about you know, living within our means, pushing decision making closer to the local level, no new taxes without a vote of the people. That's Jerry. You know, nobody's like writing the script for him to say that stuff. So I mean, that spot, I think, you know, kind of laid out the basis of where we were going to go, because what we wanted to do was lay down that sort of bio, remind people, get people to tune in, and then start to really contrast between the authentic Jerry Brown, just him, no whistles, him to camera, and with Goldman Sachs, you know, some of the other things that we wanted to get into, who do you trust, and the character issue that they wanted to avoid, I think.
So as we were heading to the first debate, we had 3 weeks of TV now under our belt. The numbers had moved from down a couple points. We were up about 4 going into the September 28th debate. And so our focus wasn't on those under the age of 50 that didn't know him. I mean, I think our focus was on how can the debate reinforce what we had now been saying on TV, showing Jerry to be the genuine, you know, real guy, not scripted, but down to earth and direct in terms of what whatever he was talking about, reinforcing some of the governing principles that had been laid out in the advertising spots. And we weren't into a target like under the age of 50. That's who we need to speak to on this debate that maybe didn't know him or not.
My reaction to the first debate was that I thought Meg Whitman actually did a pretty good job, and I think among a lot of Republicans, we weren't sure how she'd hold up under that. But having said that, Jerry supplied the comfort level that the public needed after the onslaught of negative advertising over the summer. And I think he was very effective. He came across as you said, unscripted and experienced. And she was still a little bit canned, a little bit too scripted, still did a good job, was spontaneously answered a number of tough questions, but he won that first debate.
Was Whitman, you raised sort of an interesting point about Whitman. Was she over-managed? Was she over-handled by consultants? I mean, in the primary, there was this moment where she hadn't done any interviews going into the Republican convention. You know, a press narrative had started on that. She showed up and she answered questions for an hour, and she was fine. I mean, that was my basic sense of that. Do you think that more Whitman may have shown us a different result rather than just this sort of air war?
If she had behaved the whole campaign the way she behaved at that Republican convention where she spent an hour with the press, I think her whole image would have been more positive going into the general election. I think it really hurt her, and it was a cumulative thing of ducking the press and you know, not being spontaneous, not being able to answer questions on policy, even though she's quite good. I mean, she had mastered a lot of policy material, and I went to quite a few meetings with her. I mean, these were just campaign fundraisers or briefings of her people, and she was excellent on her feet in these meetings. And it didn't come out in the campaign. It was quite remarkable. So I don't know whether to explain it by being overmanaged or being insecure and overmanaging yourself, but it was one of the two.
I don't know. I knew who I was voting for. I didn't watch the first debate.
Of course, no matter who did what in the first debate, the next morning was a rather interesting one. What did you all know about the possibility of a Nikki developing in this campaign, and what did you, I mean, just sort of walk us through that day for you. Sterling?
I knew nothing and to this day barely understand what happened.
There was a report by a reporter that you had mentioned something like this coming up.
That was a nine-word answer.
It was not a total surprise that it happened. The timing of it was not something that we were involved in at all, or the exact circumstances of how Nikki kind of emerged on the stage. That's not something that we were involved in.
Did you know specifically it was her? And did you know?
No.
How much detail
no.
did you know?
Practically none. We knew that there may be an immigration-related issue. I knew. I should preface this by saying I don't want to speak for anyone else. This is what I knew going into it, is that there may be an immigration-related issue for Meg Whitman. And we certainly wanted, obviously, that people to be prepared for that. And we did take some steps to try and lay the groundwork there. It was a surprise that it came out the day after the debate. I mean, just on a personal level, I was almost a little disappointed because I thought the debate had gone so well. I could have lived with a couple more days of positive Jerry Brown coverage off that.
Yeah, because one thing before we get there, I mean, because I think there's one part. The Clinton ad was, I think there was the critical one, another critical moment for us was turning the table on the Clinton ad and the Pinocchio ad. And that was another case where, you know, David Doak, who had done stuff in the past for Wesley and for Gray Davis, and was part of our kitchen cabinet. We were all on the phone, and we were talking about how we're going to turn this into a lie. I mean, it's a lie. We need to do that. And said, well, why don't you, what about Pinocchio? It's an old thing, but maybe we could do that. And so we went about, I immediately wrote the scripts and got them to Steve, and we started to do all the animation and stuff. But the whole question was, how hard do we do this? Because, again, we were trying to keep this tone thing. So, I mean, but I think that quickly, I mean, and we were running by in 15s. It was like, it was, I think, a real decision in the campaign, to the first one to really engage her.
Right, and I would say one more thing, which is that I would say the first 3 weeks after Labor Day were pretty well planned out, and this was the first point in which by what the Whitman campaign was doing, we were reconsidering what we were doing and the impact on our budget. Because again, we didn't have a lot of money. We were now doing better with our fundraising because we came to Labor Day not as far down, so everybody felt we were definitely in this race. I talked earlier how we had a $30 million budget, and this is the point where we're trying to think of, well, maybe we can get to 35, and our fundraising was a little bit more robust. So do we want to change our plan now and from the first 3 weeks that have been laid out and do something in response to this Clinton ad, which we did see as potentially damaging?
You did. So you thought that was potentially a damaging ad.
Yeah, but also not only potentially damaging, but maybe there's an opportunity to really turn it, you know, really stick it in people's head that she's lying. And I think we really accomplished that. And there was a little bit of fear about, are we being too demeaning? Are we going over the top? That kind of stuff. And so there were several versions of that, those animations as well. But we chose the right one. And I think, you know, it made the impact that we wanted.
But again, you know, I'm living in the world of money limitations. Right. How much can we put on this ad? And so we did make a choice that we thought we could make a difference with 500 points, basically, to go on that ad, which is about $1 million. Yeah. And so we decided, let's go ahead, let's add it in to what we already had on the air. That, as Joe said, you don't ever want to go out and say your opponent's a liar, because people say that's too harsh, you don't believe it. But we did feel at that point that the foundation had now been established, that there had been enough things that she had said that were untruthful, that we felt comfortable that we could be that strong. And we went and we inserted that in the second week, which when we had not planned to do so.
Was there any, I mean, getting back to the Nikki Diaz issue, was there any similar thinking on the Republican side that this could perhaps be an asset, that, you know, Gloria Allred had injected herself into the campaign? I mean, the Whitman campaign, that was their reaction when they came out. They tried to make it an issue about Gloria Allred. They tried to say that this was, you know, part of the Democratic hit machine. Was that just flailing, or was that an actual line of critique that had
some potential to
I'm
resonate.
I'm glad to address that, but I'd like to know a little bit more about the interaction of what happened over there, because, you know, we were hearing a week to 10 days before this thing dropped. We heard a union. We didn't know it was the nurses' union, and we knew they were shopping it. And Gloria Allred obviously had been part of a hit piece on Schwarzenegger back in 06. But getting to your part of the question, I think there was a feeling of, okay, we got to counterattack it and go after Allred. But I think the second aspect of the Whitman response, where she stood up and said, you know, I don't know about the letter, and maybe Nikki, you know, intercepted it, and then an hour or two later, her husband's signature shows up on a sheet of paper. That, to me, was an iconic moment in the campaign.
Just for the record, you know, none of the unions that we were working with, you know, were involved in that. That was a different one altogether. But it doesn't, you know, regardless of who knew what, you know, in the week or 10 days before, the people who knew a year before were the Whitman folks. I mean, they knew about it the whole time. So, you know, let's not, you know, dance around that.
Roger, thing. Yes, absolutely. And there's a real problem there, but I'd still love to hear the story.
Over cookies, we'll have some. We'll talk about it later.
So she had, by this point, spent more than a year talking about how she really had to target young people who usually don't vote in the highest propensity, and women and independent voters and Latinos. And this one incident has the potential of rolling all of that off the table. At least
more than potential.
More. Yes, right. So what, I mean, at the time, are you thinking it's gone?
The difference in the mood of the people that I would interact with that were actively working on the campaign at 10 a.m. that morning versus 7 p.m. that night was materially different. They knew.
Mm-hmm. Sure, look, you pretty viciously attack your primary opponent. You pretty viciously attack your general election opponent. And then you take someone who you say is part of your family and you call her a liar and a thief. That's not helpful.
Well, she said extended family, though. That was extended family.
It plays into the narrative that has already been developed that's not good for you. And the other side, I mean, this is an interesting panel, because I think Joe said this and Steve said it 7 or 8 times. Tone. You tried to maintain a tone of respect while at the same time you were taking the wood to your opponent. This, it was a horrible thing. And I think Roger is right, although, you know, everyone knows there were two Whitman campaigns, the Silicon Valley group and the guys that run campaigns. I will go to my grave believing the professionals who run campaigns in California for Republicans and have run successful campaigns either didn't know about it or didn't know the extent of it, because it was a political crime to trot her out, allow her to say what she said, only to have Gloria Allred come back and prove it to be incorrect. And the only silver lining was Gloria Allred, because she was so polarizing. But notwithstanding the fact that people on both sides of the aisle find that woman offensive, it still had a huge impact in the race.
Well, let me just say this, because she's not here to defend herself. I don't find Gloria Allred offensive at all. And I find her to be a fierce, tough advocate for the causes in which she works, and I thought that she did a great job for Nikki, and I applaud her for taking that case and advocating.
And
on
you
her
plan
behalf.
To use her in 2014.
We're stunned. No, but the other thing I would agree with, though, is that there was, at some level, there was either no knowledge or malpractice, to know that was there for a year or whatever, and to not. There are different things they could have done in a positive way to get in front of it, maybe do. I mean, and it's just insane that the way that came out and where they put
could,
it.
Could, whether could
she may have done it
to
herself by not telling them, but that's, I mean, I don't.
Sure, look, well. I mean, I'm not, I didn't see the polling. I wasn't involved in either of the pollsters of either side, but it's not necessarily what you do, but it's how you do it. I mean, I don't know how you can be a billionaire say someone's part of your family, find out she's illegal, fire her, and not even give her enough severance and hire a lawyer to help her out. Now, look, clearly that's a problem. There's no good way of dealing with that. That said, I'm not sure they didn't take the least worst way. But again, I don't know what the polling showed, but I thought it was a gift.
Could she have brought it up in the Republican primary if she knew about it and inoculated herself? Or would it have been a death blow in the primary?
Look, I think you have to look again. I'll defer to the guys who were in the arena on this, but politicians always have an instinct to hide their skeletons. George Bush managed to figure out how to lose 5 points in a presidential election because he thought he could keep drunk driving in the closet in a campaign. Had he brought that out a week before the Republican convention, it would not have cost us 5 points when it hit on Thursday before the election. I don't think it would have helped her, however she brought it out, but, you know, I'm not sure it could have been brought out in a way that hurt her any more.
But what you don't do though is go around the state for a year saying you need to hold employers accountable, okay, for hiring undocumented workers, okay, knowing all that she and her some level her leadership team knew. You don't do that. And that's certainly what she did. And she wanted to immediately deflect attention to us on this whole thing and refused to take responsibility for her own actions.
This was the political equivalent of the Michael Huffington meltdown at the end of that campaign and Bill Simon's fraud trial in the middle of the summer.
And it was immediately followed by the second debate where a young woman stands up in the crowd, honor student, I think triple major, about to graduate, and sort of pleads her case with the candidate who basically says, you don't belong here. It was all of a piece.
Well, you know, at that point, it's kind of like, I know what you're trying to get to, but it's like in a battle, right? I mean, you know you're retreating. You're not really sure whether it's because the artillery, the guns, or the grenades, but clearly the cumulative effect is not positive.
But, you know, she could have done both things. So you could have done what she was saying on immigration, that, look, we've got to hold employers responsible, and we've got to enforce, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in that, say, and we've got to be tough. And let me tell you, I screwed up once. I screwed up once.
No, I know firsthand why this is important because I had an employee.
All she had to do was one time, the very first time she talked about it back a year ago, she could still have held her position about being but just say, look, it happened to me. Let me tell you how it happened. I was forced, here's with somebody in my family, but we got to be tough on this. We got to stop. You know, she could have done that, and I think it was getting caught in this sort of hypocrisy, trying to hide it. Again, going in, if you now look at, we've been running Pinocchio. We've got put a lie detector ad up after that. Everything sort of going at, can you trust what this woman's saying? And all of a sudden, she's got this thing going on all at the same time. It just got drove right into where we were trying to send people.
Answer your question, I do think it would have been a serious problem in a Republican primary. But this goes to how do you assess your chances as a candidate at the beginning? If you can't disclose something because of the Republican primary and then you get caught in the general, I mean, that's why I said the campaign was over on June 7th, because with the level of the immigration issue that had been raised in the primary and knowing internally whether the campaign consulting team, certainly the candidate and her husband, what they knew, they wasted a lot of money after that. I think it was over.
So was that the moment? I mean, was the campaign over at that point when Nikki Diaz comes forward, or was it over before then? I mean,
yeah. We were up 4 going into the first debate. That week of the 28th, we had the Davis debate, then we had the disclosure on Wednesday, then we had the Fresno debate. And so at the end of that week, we were up by 8. There's an argument that said we had a good debate performance that might have helped things a little bit. Fresno created some more problems for her. And obviously, the Nikki Diaz thing was a problem. So the factual numbers were up by 4 going into that week, and then we were up by 8. Okay.
We had the same sort of thing we were doing. That was about the only thing we were doing at that point was polling and tracking. And we had just prior to the first debate, Jerry was already starting to pull away, and starting to get the swings over to him. And then after that whole series, we were showing the exact same thing.
And there was the small matter of the whore comment, which turned out to be a small matter, but Sterling, who said it? And
I don't know.
Oh, come on.
Anyone else?
It wasn't me.
Steve, no.
Steve, yes. Steve?
What's the question again?
Who said it?
If you've been to our campaign office, we're in a giant warehouse.
You're dissembling.
It's all open ceiling. There's only one single office in the whole place. And around Jerry's desk, where the phone call was made, sits at least 6 or 7 staffers within a desk and a half. Plus, there were people that had joined for that call to talk about it. So there were a lot of people in the room.
How many of them were women?
4 or 5.
Yeah, there are a number of them. But what's noteworthy about it? Just again, this is something that we were experiencing firsthand, and it was certainly a point of frustration. Is that the Police Protective League of Los Angeles, working on behalf of the Whitman campaign, released the recording to the LA Times with a transcript that had the transcript say this was from Jerry Brown. And so when it came to us, it was the accusation that Jerry was the person uttering this language. And the reporting blurred a little bit of what this language was. And the quote that was in the transcript had an individual, in this case identified as Jerry, saying, "Should we call her a whore? Should we?" was a question. And then there was a claim in this transcript later on that then the word whore was uttered by the same person. So that was the claim that was being made by the Police Protective League. When we got it, we listened to it. It was a very tough recording to hear. We didn't think it was Jerry. Later on that night, we got the so-called enhanced version that supposedly made it clearer, and we didn't know the source of that. We thought the source was the Times. So we certainly circulated it among the leadership group and the jury, and we could not make out, from our point of view, who it was, except we were pretty darn confident at that point it wasn't Jerry, and that and so we said so, but keep in mind, and this applied to some other things that happened in the course of the campaign. We apologized that night. We apologized for the salty language, and we didn't play a lot of games about it. We just came up and we said that language was used, and we're sorry for it, in private. And
did it not ultimately matter because people expect that kind of, stuff to come from Brown's mouth,
right?
Or because they determined that it didn't come from Brown's mouth, and so there was some distance from the candidate?
Right. When these things happen, it's like the propaganda issue again. You don't really know its impact, and certainly you think about it and wonder, is this going to affect us or not affect us? And it did. The context for it was well reported. It came up in the context of the police union giving their endorsement to Whitman, in part because she created an exception to her position that she wanted to phase out defined benefit plans, but there was a carve out this exception for public safety. And so there was a, I think in the reporting, correctly so, the context that it was a reference to making a deal. And so it did soften what we thought was a potential exposure on the issue. We did subsequently poll and track it specifically and saw it had absolutely no effect. Now, it did have the benefit of taking the dialogue away from Nikki and her hypocrisy on immigration and kind of put us back in the spotlight again. And that remained through that last debate on October 5th, where the moderator, resurfaced the issue in an interesting and some would say unfair manner. So we did have about a week or so of the political oxygen was taken up by that issue.
But I don't think it actually got reported anywhere that it was Jerry who actually used the word. I mean, I think
never reported.
Right, over the course of the first night of going over the tape, I think everyone at the LA Times, all the other reporters who listened to it enough to report on it, pretty clearly came to the same conclusion that it was clearly not Jerry Brown because, you know, he appeared in several other points on the tape. So nobody, I don't think, and, you know, the Whitman campaign never really even advanced the argument that it was Jerry who said it. And so once you're past that point, you know, I don't think it's shocking to people. I think it's more of a surprise that every 4 years you get through 2 days of this conference without political consultants using terrible, terrible language than it would surprise anyone to hear political professionals using bad language in a campaign office. So I just don't.
We've been on our best behavior today, though.
That's right. I shouted some expletives in the street to get it out of my system before I got here.
We had the USC LA Times poll, or LA Times USC poll, whatever each side chooses to call it, did polling right before that whole blow up and right after that blow off. Women support, Brown support among women went from 9 to 21 point margin, among Latinos from 20 to 34, among DTS voters from 6 to 37.
You're talking 30. About the MAID issue, not the.
Talking about the MAID issue from late September to late October. It encompassed both things. Was that what you were seeing internally as well?
Certainly the large numbers were we were up 8 by the first week in October, and it really just hung there for 2 or 3 weeks. So by the time your poll came out, we weren't seeing a lot of change from what had happened earlier in the month. We did see the movement for women. We didn't really see the same erosion that people had been seeing with Latinos throughout the whole summer and the fall. So I don't dispute what you guys saw. You guys had a much larger sample than is typically done with Latinos, and I think that spoke to the caliber of the polling that the Times did. And so I can only believe that is true.
I'd just like to raise another issue, just kind of throw it out here. I would say that my personal relationship with every individual in the press that I've dealt with has always been fair, and any time I've had a problem, I've been able to go back to them. But I just want to raise the issue in the campaign, both in terms of the involvement of the nurses union in the Nikki Diaz case and in terms of the way that the whore issue was dealt with. It seemed to me that there was a lack of curiosity by the press to really actively pursue those stories. And I just think, you know, for the benefits, since this is about the history and where we go from here, I just am a little concerned about, the lack of curiosity on an objective basis, and B, you know, I'm not totally objective, but I tend to feel that it leans a little bit against us. Were those even significant issues, or did that make any difference in these campaigns? Absolutely not. But I just think it's a concern that I have long term. So I just feel like at some point I need to raise it.
Members of the press can bring this up during the Q&A, but I'm not sure that lack of printed stories equates lack of interest. I think that I know certainly on our part there was a great deal of interest. I think the Chronicle ultimately broke the
after the campaign.
Story.
I mean, Carla did a nice job breaking it out. But why was it? I mean, that was a major series of events, a very complicated strategy that was implemented, and to not have any stories come up on that until after the election, I think really is not the press's best hour.
I'll just say I disagree that there was a lack of curiosity on those issues, having been on the receiving end of those phone calls on a daily basis.
Well, you did a great job of stonewalling.
Well, that's, you know, I mean, the first thing is that obviously, you know, as the story of the nurses union involvement came out after the campaign, I'm going to guess that there was some difficult and in-depth reporting that took place there. And in the timeline of a campaign, like, sometimes that's just how long those things take to report out, and we didn't have a lot of information to provide there. But the second issue is those are really secondary concerns. I think, you know, everyone was curious about where Nikki came from. There's no question about that. But that's also totally irrelevant to the issue of how Meg Whitman interacted with a woman who her family employed for a number of years. And that was really, you know, from a voter's perspective, that's what was relevant about the Nikki Diaz story.
Well, again, if this was a one-off, maybe. But, you know, it was done in the recall with Schwarzenegger, called a Nazi, and all the, you know, the women. I mean, it was with Allred, too. So there clearly is a pattern, and it was union involvement. And I think that it's, so it's not just a one-time small, especially in light of Meg's conduct. Clearly, that was the much bigger issue. Right. All I'm saying, there was a real story there, and I'm disappointed that it wasn't more aggressively followed.
Well, to defend the newspaper on the Arnold front, I mean, he announced in early August, the election was in October. There wasn't a great deal of time to build in a story that came out well in advance of the election. I mean, I was an editor on that election. I didn't even know about the story. That thing was closely held within the paper. It was not gossiped about. It did not involve Gloria. Afterwards, it did. She came out afterwards, but not in
during the initial
part of our investigation of it. That was not her.
No, my point is that they even hired a group back in Philadelphia with respect to Schwarzenegger in September to roll this thing out, and right before the election, they dropped this thing about the womanizing. So it was really a concerted effort, again, of a union and Allred for an attack on the Republicans. That's all I'm saying.
Poison is the one who should be most upset about all this.
Exactly. Late in the campaign, the Echo ad comes out, where we have her uttering some lines, Arnold uttering some lines, back and forth. Widely seen as an extremely effective, devastating, even ad. How concerned were you all along, and I think you may have mentioned it early on in this conversation, about the fact that a woman from a business background, a Republican, was trying to replace a Republican governor whose favorables were somewhere in the range of 22 through most of the campaign, and that there was some sense in California that we had advanced the revolutionary boil in 2003, and so it wasn't necessarily as strong here as it was in other parts of the country in 2010.
Well, you know, I wasn't here for yesterday morning's presentation on the primary, but the strategists for Poizner always thought that this election would be about the anti-Arnold. It struck me that the Whitman campaign thought it was going to be about Jerry Brown and his years in public service, and we always thought experience actually worked to his advantage. So I'm not sure they even got the paradigm right. I thought the Echo ad was horribly effective.
That's a compliment.
And it was consistent what the Poizner people actually thought the election could be about. You know, in fact, I think Poizner even used Meg's going to run for Arnold's third term. And so it was consistent with where a lot of us thought the electorate might actually be, whether you liked Arnold or not. We thought it was a devastatingly effective ad. It was simple. You didn't have to explain it to people. They could watch it once and they got it. And whoever, you know, came up with that and crafted it should get all of the pollies and all the awards that political consultants get, because I thought it was a great icing on a cake.
Who came up with that, Joe? There was a story going around that there was an intern who put that together.
This is like, it goes into how this campaign kind of operated, and just a great team and like I said, kitchen cabinet and folks. Actually, what happened on this one is Michael Berman's told Jerry that, hey, they've said a lot of the same things. You guys should take a look at that. There might be a spot there. And this is like months before we get here. So Christina Steffi, who's on my staff, she's Tripping Associates, she's in the headquarters all the time for like months and months and months. We put her there because she's a really good editor. She can cut YouTube videos. She can cut spots. She can do it really quickly. It was a great idea until Jerry realized it and realized he could look over his shoulder and see what spots we were getting. But in any case, we mentioned, you know, Steve and I said to her, hey, can you start, just go check and find as much stuff as you can of the two of them saying the same thing. A few days later,
She said, hey, you want to look at this? And yeah, and it just went on and on and on. I mean, much longer than a 30-second spot of them saying the same thing. And it didn't, I'd like to say that it took would take a rocket scientist after the first 5 seconds to say that's going to be a problem for her, but it didn't take a rocket scientist. I mean, anybody looking at it. And our biggest problem at that point was, okay, what's going to make it in the final version? Mm-hmm. And since we had literally 2 months or so to consider that conundrum, there were several versions that we all kept kicking around. The funniest moment, though, was we could not find her saying the definition of insanity. That line is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. And so that's how we wanted to start it, and we had him saying it, and then we had all the other things that we were considering. And she's every spare moment where she's not cutting Pinocchio or something else, she's looking for that on the net, and we can't find it. And in the middle of the debate, Meg Whitman says it. Now, that wouldn't be so bad, but Paul Blank, who is on my staff and is a big part of this too, was at the debate and in the middle of the press room goes, yeah! Because he knew that we finally had it. And everybody, all you guys are looking around, all the press is kind of like, what the hell was that about? You know, that was an attack on your guy. And, you know, so, and then what we've been trying to say is exactly what's been said is, you know, hey, we tried that. It didn't work. And the Mercury, in its endorsement of us, had said that, and we grabbed that. We finally had a good ending for it. And the real problem was, we again getting back to the discipline of this campaign. It was not in our plan to run that spot. I mean, we all wanted to run it. Don't get me wrong, but we had this plan about a real discipline about the messages that we wanted to get out and how we wanted, you know, what the first spot, what the next five spots would be, and like it was so good that like it'd be like you kind of like we're in the meeting going, Dad, now can we put it up? Now can we put it up? So that you know, but. But by the time we still stayed disciplined. We didn't go off and run it, no matter how badly we wanted to. We waited and waited until we had gotten the case that we wanted to make, and then there were 2 weeks left at that point, and we like, if we don't put it up right now, it's not going. And also, Steve had a good point of this, is that, you know, right now we had an 8 to 10 point lead, I think, and this is going to take a lot of the oxygen. People will be talking about this, and that'll, you know, that means we're less chance of them listening to what's going on. You know, this will hold it and may help, but it's going to hold it. And so we finally did put it up, and then the same thing with the final spot, which was the 30 years.
Moved to California 30 years ago.
She said she moved to California 30 years ago, and it was a great place. And yeah, except that Jerry was governor then. And that ad had the exact same kind of role. It was more about sort of, you know, people really talked about it. Let me give you that ad became one of the top 10 political viral ads in the entire year. You know, across the country, 400,000 people watched that one. I just want to throw out a couple of things that, because I think Ned and the Brown staff and Tom on my staff worked on the internet. I mean, there were 1.1 million Twitter followers, 1.4 million YouTube views on the channel, nearly $3 million raised online. I mean, there are a lot of things going on in this campaign. A lot of people on the team who deserve a lot of the credit that, you know, aren't sitting up here today.
My thanks to the IGES people who worked on this conference. I'm not going to name them all, Steve. But anyway, thank you all for coming, and please join me in thanking this panel and all of the panelists.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.